Sylvia and me.
Hi, I'm Sylvia Beckerman. Join me today as I talk to an extraordinary woman who is changing the world by making a difference in her life and the lives of those around her.
Hi, my name is Olivia Wells. I'm the Director of Programs and Impact at Nadia's Initiative. Welcome to Sylvia and Me.
Olivia, I am so happy to have you here today. And we are social distancing. In fact, where are you?
Right now, I am quarantined in Lithuania.
And I'm in Connecticut. I am so glad that you agreed to this. And I learned about Nadia. I interviewed Gail Kaibaka. She did 100 portraits of women for, I think it's Vital Voices.
Yes, yep, absolutely.
And I took a look and, you know, what you guys have done, what you're doing is unbelievable. So I am very happy that, you know, I don't care how many times we rescheduled that you're able to do this, because I think, again, the message is one that I want people to hear. I want them to hear your story, and I want them to hear, you know, about your career, which is, it's fantastic.
No, thank you very much for reaching out. And I'm sorry that Nadia was not able, but I'm still thrilled to be here speaking.
All right, I'm thrilled to have you. Before we get into the amazing work and who you are, why are you in Lithuania right now?
I'm in Lithuania because my husband is Lithuanian. I met him while studying my bachelor's degree. And it just so happened that we had decided to do a civil ceremony in January because it was always my intention to move back to Europe after living here 8 years. And it was appropriate for Nadia's Initiative as well, because a lot of our partners, both donor partners and implementing partners, are European-based organizations. So it made sense to have someone here, especially the director of programs. And he's from here. So we came back to do the civil ceremony and basically get me my European residency. And this all happened to just, like, I got my European residency. We did the marriage. I got my European residency and boom, quarantine hit. So the timing was brilliant, considering that I would be in trouble if I was here and didn't have the residency. I don't know what would have happened, but yes, yeah, since then we've been hunkering down here for the past couple months.
Well, congratulations on your marriage, because I know and you were going to celebrate in Greece. That will put off. But that kind of leads me into, you were talking about Europe. When did you realize that you wanted to pursue a career in human rights? I'd like you to talk a little bit about your life trajectory, and how many countries have you kind of lived in?
Yeah, sure. It's an unusual trajectory. I've lived in 8 different countries, or 8 different cities. It might be 7 different countries. I'm not quite sure if I'm remembering that correctly. And I've been to, I think, 35 different countries, both for work, study, and just travel. But to take it back to way back, I was a ballet dancer. I studied ballet for 15 years, and from 3 to 18. And kind of at 18, I decided, you know, that I didn't want to go on the professional dancer track. But I had, because I had been doing it for so long, I didn't know what I wanted to do instead of ballet. So I actually took a couple years off before pursuing my undergrad degree. And I traveled. I lived in Venezuela for a while. I worked and saved a lot of money, because my parents said, look, if you're going to take this time off, that's fine, but you have to pay for your own education. I said, yep, no problem. Which I think is a really great thing for young people to have to do, because you learn very early on how to manage your finances.
Very true.
So when I finally did go to school, I initially went to University of Southern California in Los Angeles, and I was studying Middle East studies and classics. And the classics portion of my degree brought me to Athens, Greece for a semester abroad. And I loved it so much that I ended up staying there for a year. And what happened in the second semester especially was that I started shifting away from the classics degree and shifting towards the Middle East studies degree, with particular respect to human rights, peace and conflict resolution, democracy implementation, civic mobilization, these kind of things. So I started taking more classes in those fields. And at the end of that year, I said to my parents, I said, I'm sorry, I love you guys, but I don't want to come back to the US. I knew that if I went back to University of Southern California, I would have to continue working two jobs and face, you know, looming debt. And I had discovered that Europe was much, much more affordable. And so, very long story short about applying to different places, I actually ended up in Lithuania for my undergrad degree, which cost me a whopping $1,000 a year.
Which is okay, a big, 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 big difference.
Yes, big difference from, I think, the 70K that University of Southern California was. And it was actually the best decision of my life, I must say. Wow, it was a turning point, because it was a great setup financially, in terms of I would come back to New York every summer and I would work my ass off as a server and also do internships. So I was basically working 7 days a week, but I would use the money. Working as a server in New York City before coronavirus was great, because you can make really good money. And basically the money that I would make working as a server those 4 months would last me the entire 8 months while I was abroad in Lithuania studying. So it was really great. I was able to support myself in that sense. And I came out of my shell in a lot of ways in Lithuania. I became very active in the university, in student groups, in UN youth organizations, reaching out to young people, getting them excited about human rights and the work of the UN. And every summer I would do an internship that was related. I think what I try to tell young people now is that it's super important to be assertive and to seek out opportunities on your own and not wait for them to come to you. Because through that, I ended up becoming a consultant for PACT International, this incredible human rights organization. I was working on democracy implementation and civic mobilization in Eastern Europe. I went back to Greece actually again, and worked with a local NGO that provides social services to refugees in Greece and homeless Greeks. So it really, that point when I decided to move to Lithuania, as well, obviously, as you know, I met my future husband. It was a great turning point, because it was a stepping stone of me living in all these different countries and working in all these different countries. And I do not regret this decision at all. But after to go forward a bit, I finished my bachelor's degree, because I was a bit older, I said, okay, I wanna jump into the master's actually relatively quickly. And that brought me to Cape Town, South Africa, University of Cape Town, where I studied master's in human rights law with a focus on women's rights and international criminal law.
Now,
and it was, yes, sorry, please.
No, what I wanna ask you is, so everything that you were doing before you started your master's and majored in human rights, mm-hmm. you focused on women's rights and international criminal law. When did you know that that's kind of what you wanted to do?
I think in Greece in that second semester, because when I did transfer to school in Lithuania, I transferred to the International Politics and Development program, which was heavily focused on human rights and democracy. So it was it was very much that second semester in Greece when I was expecting to go back to LA that I fell in love with that field. And it kept growing the more and more I was exposed to different human rights organizations in Europe and in the US every summer that I would return.
So after you finished your master's, where did you go from there?
So I came back to the US and I'm not ashamed to say I worked as a server again to pay off any debt I had accrued from my master's degree.
Nothing wrong with that.
And I started applying for jobs. And again, something that I also tell other people that are younger people that are now applying for jobs that have come out of their master's or bachelor's, it's for most people, I think, it's a process unless you have the necessary connections. You apply for months and it can really get you down if you continue being rejected, or even beyond that, if you get to the third and fourth stage and then you're rejected. And that happened to me quite a lot during that period. But I said, all right, it's not the right fit. If it didn't happen, it's not the right fit. And that sentiment could not have been more true than when I found Nadia's initiative and everything just clicked. I found an organization that was at the nexus point of everything I loved and cared about and actually had a background in. So, yeah.
Well, just to give some background, Nadia's initiative, Nadia Murad is an activist from the persecuted Yazidi religious minority in Iraq and a former captive of ISIS, and she was jointly awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2018 for her efforts to end the use of sexual violence as a weapon of war in armed conflict. So can you now talk about Nadia's initiative? What is their mission?
Yeah, absolutely. So the initiative was founded in the beginning of 2018. And what our work is twofold, right? It's we focus on rebuilding communities in crisis and advocating for survivors of sexual violence. And the community that we're focusing on right now, for obvious reasons, is the Yazidi community in Sinjar. We work only in Sinjar, Iraq, in terms of our programmatic work on the ground. The reason for that is it's been 6 years since the genocide against the Yazidi community by ISIS. And only 20% of the community has actually returned to Sinjar, which is their ancestral homeland. That's about 110,000 Yazidis have now returned to Sinjar since 2014, right? But over 200,000 are still in IDP camps, spread in northern Iraq and throughout the region. And the remaining, so it's about 500,000 before ISIS, the remaining have relocated to Europe, Canada, Australia, the US, and other parts of the world. So it's quite, we call the situation an emergency because we see it as such that 6 years have gone by and little to nothing has been done to help this community return to their homeland. And to be blunt, the IDP camps are not sustainable. These kind of camps are created for disaster situations, but they're not meant to be lived in for years on end. But unfortunately, all over the world, that's what happens. That's what often happens. And that's what's happening with the Yazidis. And in these camps, they don't have access to adequate education, healthcare, water and sanitation, employment opportunities. So Nadia looked at the situation and said, all right, what everyone's focusing, all these humanitarian agencies are focusing on pouring money into the camps, but this is a short-term solution. We need to be more long-term thinking in our approach. So let's just, as Nadia's initiative, focus our efforts on rebuilding Sinjar. Let's focus on restoring the education system in the region. Let's focus on restoring the healthcare system in the region and improving it and making it more comprehensive than it was before ISIS. Let's focus on women's empowerment in livelihoods and rebuilding all the farming communities that were destroyed by ISIS throughout the region. So that's the focus of our programmatic work right now. We're providing basic services and restoring infrastructure in the Sinjar region for Yazidis that are currently there, and also to incentivize and enable the return of those that are still displaced. And please.
And That sounds like it's a mission that is necessary instead of, as you said, funding these temporary areas that were specifically made temporary. And now you're trying to restore what was. Can you tell me, so with everything you mentioned, how is the virus affecting the mission?
Yes, it's impacting the area quite a bit. I mean, I have to say that Iraq, and I think countries similar to Iraq, understand that a lot is at stake with a pandemic like this. So they've taken quite strict measures to mitigate its spread. But when you have vulnerable communities that are then cut off from, they're already vulnerable, and then they're cut off from their resources and their support, that makes them even more vulnerable, right? And that's what we're seeing in Iraq at the moment. So almost all our projects are on hold, or all our programmatic areas are on hold right now, because there's strict curfews throughout the region and there's limited movement throughout the region. But what we decided to do as a team is say, okay, look, and while we're waiting for these curfews to be lifted, we need to switch our focus to COVID-19 emergency response. So what we've been doing since this pandemic started to spread in the region is because we're led by community members, and we have community members on the ground sort of overseeing and monitoring our projects, we have very close ties to, you know, the local healthcare networks, the local police force, the local governance in the region. And so we've been working with all these sectors to sanitize villages and towns, to deliver PPE to the existing hospitals in the region and the primary health centers in the region, and very importantly, to actually distribute emergency kits to the most vulnerable families in the region. And these kits include a variety of food products and sanitation products for families up to 6 for up to a week. So thus far, we've hit a couple thousand families in the region, and we're continuing this work because obviously once a week goes by, these families still need additional support. So we're looking to hit another 4,000 families in the next couple of weeks.
And how many families in total are we talking about?
There's 110,000 people in the region. So if I had to guesstimate, although to be honest, it's hard to know exactly the numbers because of these access issues, I would say maybe 40,000 families.
So one of the things that Nadia's initiative is able to do is focus and kind of change what you were planning and just deal with what needs to be dealt with now, which is a huge crisis that we're going through. So where is the most help needed?
That's a loaded question. I mean, what we're doing now, actually, we're working as a team to kind of build out our strategic plan and look at exactly what you just asked me for the next 3 years. And, you know, of course, in addition to our programmatic work, there's all the advocacy work that we do as well. And that's led by Nadia, who's been an incredible force for legislative change and reform for women and survivors, generally speaking, of genocide and sexual violence. So we're going to continue doing that advocacy work, right? Because that's always needed. In terms of programmatic work, we're honing in our focus on health, education, livelihoods, and women's empowerment. But if I had to talk about right now, I would say in the COVID, you know, scenario, the most pressing needs are health. The healthcare sector was already not in great shape before COVID hit. So we're actually working with a couple American NGOs that focus on health access to healthcare and improving access to healthcare. And we're also trying to do some long-term work while COVID's going on to improve access to testing and improve training of healthcare professionals in the region. So definitely we need to boost the healthcare system in Iraq. We need support to do that. Because we don't know how long this pandemic is going to go on, and we need to ensure that there are proper mitigation measures in place there. And the other thing I would say that goes hand in hand with that is livelihoods. There's a lot of food insecurity in the region. That's why we do a lot of work in the farming sector, restoring farming households in the region. And actually, we were about to start a project restoring female-headed households farming properties in the region before this hit. But so food security is a big issue. It's going to be an ongoing need to try to get food supplies to these families that are stuck in quarantine, and perhaps their farms are not yet rehabilitated, so they don't have access to food off their land. I would say health and livelihoods.
Okay. You've got a lot of work ahead of you. So you said you're working with a couple of U.S. NGOs for help with the healthcare. Let's talk a little bit. No one knows when this pandemic, when this crisis is going to abate, slow down, what our new normal is, people talk about. What are some of the programs that you have to kind of put on hold right now that you would like to be able to get back to once we could get some of the programs, the issues that you just talked about in place, and know that it's much better and it's on its way to being even better than that?
Yeah, so we were set to implement a massive water sanitation and hygiene services project in North Sinjar, and that project, which it's still going to happen, but it's of course on hold, is due to benefit about 65,000 people. So that was quite a big project. We have been doing a ton of restoration of primary, intermediary, and high schools throughout the region. Not just rehabilitation, but then working with the local governments to staff and design curriculums for these schools. That's a big, big incentive for displaced Yazidis. If displaced Yazidis see that these schools are opening, they're going to come back because they don't have access to education for their children in the camps. So we're really honing in on that. We're working with USAID and other partners to restore electricity to these towns, to restore infrastructure like roads, shelter rehabilitation. We also have one of my favorites, a women's empowerment project that is now on hold. It just began, and hopefully it will be able to be implemented on time, but it's a pilot project that involves the training of 48 female survivors of sexual violence in the region, 48 women, training in small business management skills and actual setup of these small businesses for these women and maintenance of these small businesses. And that's all tied with also giving them psychosocial support, medical care. So that's a project that we're quite excited to start. Yes, and of course, actually, even in the health sector, we're building an entirely new hospital in Sinjar, a brand new, comprehensive, state-of-the-art facility with the support of the French government. We're trying to push that through. We're working with the government to get it to, you know, keep working on that despite the COVID blockades. But it's hard. We're trying to do all this work. The livelihoods work, as I mentioned, we have a project for female farming households that's due to benefit about 350 female households, and that's now on hold as well. So we're very keen for these curfews to lift so we can get back to this much needed work in the region.
Well, you certainly do have a lot on your plate, and it sounds like the initiatives that you and because I know that you're in charge of director of programs, they are very needed, and they're exciting in the way that what you foresee for the future. Can you tell, how can people help, whether it be getting involved in the initiative, or how could people listening support the vision of moving forward, bringing an end to human trafficking and sexual violence?
So there's multiple ways. I mean, of course, the one of the most tangible is of course is donations. It's not possible for everyone. I understand that, but I think people. And it's funny, until I started working for Nadia's Initiative, I had donated myself to various causes that I cared about, but not on a regular basis. And now I've started doing that because I've seen through Nadia's Initiative the impact that even a small individual donation can have on our work. For example, with this COVID response work, we sent out, you know, a newsletter saying any kind of support you can give to this would immensely help. And it's crazy to think that, you know, $20 can feed a family of six in Sinjar for a week or two. I mean, this is for not for every American, but for certain Americans, $20 is not a lot, right? And it goes so far in Iraq. So definitely, if people are in a position to support, you know, to donate, that's amazing. And then beyond that, I would say just, you know, following our work, sharing our work, following us on our platforms, sharing what we post about the community, about Nadia, about women, just amplifying the message in any way possible is also going to help. I that's what we do. That's part of our advocacy work. We amplify the message of other women and other survivors. So I think these are two very tangible ways to helping the community.
And what is the website?
www.nadiasinitiative.org.
And you can also follow Nadia's Initiative on Facebook and on Instagram. And
yes,
for you yourself, what are your, you know, what are your goals for the future?
I love my job. So for me, and I'm very invested in this community now because I think they're a community that's largely been forgotten, and they were, again, vulnerable before ISIS targeted them. So they're even more vulnerable now. So I think, you know, working with women in vulnerable communities has been something I've been doing for many years in all over the globe, but especially with marginalized communities and in poorer areas. And for me, I'm very attached to this work now. So I see my future, at least for the foreseeable future, just working with this organization to expand our impact on the communities and hopefully down the line actually, you know, rebuild Sinjar and then be able to shift our focus to another vulnerable community. That's the ideal situation, but we'll see.
Well, Olivia, the work that you and the initiative is doing is absolutely amazing, so needed, and you should be very proud of yourself for what you're doing. So I want to thank you for joining me today, for all the work that you've done, and stay well, stay safe. Greetings from Lithuania. And hopefully you'll be able to get to Greece at some point and celebrate your marriage as you had planned to do.
Yes, I hope. Thank you. Thank you very much, Sylvia, for having me on. It's been a pleasure and for lending your platform to our cause. I'm grateful. Nadia's grateful. The entire team's grateful. We really appreciate it. And I hope you stay safe and healthy as well.
Thank you for joining me today. On our next podcast, I'll be talking to another extraordinary, inspiring woman who has made her mark on the world. You can find us on your favorite podcast platform and, of course, our website, sylviaandme.com. Don't forget to hit the subscribe button to keep up with the latest episodes. Review, rate, and take us with you wherever you are. I want to hear from you. If you know of an extraordinary, inspiring woman, please contact me at sylvia@lifeofprey.com. You can also follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Stay safe. This has been a Life of Prey production.